Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Defense Uncut podcast, the first dedicated English language Pakistani defense news and commentary podcast. On Defense Uncut, we unpack Pakistan's military procurements, events, and issues in laser-focused detail so that you build an accurate and informative big picture. Following weeks of escalating tensions amid the attacks that killed 26 civilian tourists in the Pahalgam Valley on April 22nd, India initiated a wide-scale retaliatory strike against what it deemed were key terrorist sites within Pakistan on the eve of May 7th. This kicked off a brief but very intense three-day conflict between Pakistan and India that was, for the time being, put to an end following a US-led ceasefire on May 10th. However, while immediate fighting stopped, there was no doubt that these 72 hours altered South Asia's geostrategic dynamics at many, many levels, both technical, political, and not least from a security dimension. There's Pakistan's strategic, if not existential, concern of India's suspension of the Indus Water Treaty and how that will certainly impact water and food security for the majority of the Pakistani population. There's America's concern that South Asia's two nuclear rivals still haven't normalized their ties, even though Washington needs every region from Central Europe to the Middle East to South Asia to pacify so that it can focus on containing Beijing's rise. And speaking of Beijing, it has risen not just as a political and economic juggernaut, but now an adept defense technology supplier, which not only offers Pakistan a secure and reliable source of modern weapons, but other countries who aren't on great terms with America as well. And finally, and not least, there's India's rise, not just as an imposing regional power, but now a strong defense industry player in its own right, especially in the domain of standoff range strike missiles and surface-to-air missiles, to name a few among many, many budding verticals. And there's much, much more, especially in the tactics employed by both sides and, not least, the lessons each side will take away from this conflict. For Pakistan, the conflict seemed to have started along the lines it was expecting, with an opening strike led by the Indian Air Force. The Pakistan Air Force rose to the challenge, leveraging the systems it acquired from the 2019 skirmish with India, such as the new J-10 CE fighters, Q-9 VE long-range SAMs, and others. On that night, the PF claims it downed, albeit to varying degrees of probability, but not with any certainty, around 4 to 6 IAF fighter aircraft. It was the fight Pakistan, especially the PAF, had prepared to fight. But in the following days, India regrouped and brought a very, very different kind of fight, one that threw Pakistan off its footing. By the time the two sides finalized the ceasefire, the advantage was with India. Indeed, what you've just heard is not the narrative Pakistan may like you to hear. But advancing narratives is not PUA's mission. Rather, our goal is to advance the best outcomes, be it for Pakistan's key decision makers, the wider defense industry suppliers, and Pakistan's geostrategic partners. Having a clear-eyed, critical look at one's weakness and a humble awareness of fleeting advantages makes for the best outcomes. We want to give you, our respected listeners, a clear-eyed perspective at every level, from the strategic geopolitical issues right down to the tactical and technical details, so that you achieve the best outcomes in your line of work. To be clear, unpacking this conflict will take many episodes, and I'm sure we'll be referencing this conflict across many other topics as well. But to build our starting point, I have two amazing guests with me, both of whom have been resident analysts on PUA, Arsalan Khan and Asimul Islam. Arsalan Khan is a defense analyst whose work has been featured on PUA as well as other publications, such as Shepherd Media. Asim is an engineer working in the aerospace industry. I think between these two, we'll hear a balanced perspective across both the technical and operational sides of this conflict. We'll give you a high-level look at what happened through the course of the 3 days and discuss the aftermath. How much damage did both sides really take? Did Pakistan's acquisitions since the 2019 skirmish pan out as successfully as it planned? And what are some of the key lessons? So let's get into it. So, hello, Arsalan, Asim, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Nice to be here. I'm great. Great to be here.
Perfect. So I guess we can start off on May 7th. So in the early hours of the day, India launched Operation Sindoor as a series of 14 attacks targeting 9 locations in Pakistan's side of Kashmir and the Punjab province. The Dassault Rafale played a big role in the strikes, armed with the Scalp air-launched cruise missiles, the AASM Hammer standoff weapons, and the munition deployments all seemed to happen from within India. So I'll just have each of you kind of like chime in. How did Pakistan respond and how did it go?
Yeah, so on the 7th of May, we saw strikes from the Indian Air Force. It was a joint strike, I believe, between the Indian Air Force and also the Army. I believe the Army was using BrahMos as a launch from the ground, and the Air Force had a mixture of weapons. We saw Rampage strikes, we saw BrahMos, we saw Scalps. So it was quite a varied strike. And on our side, while it was to be expected, on the other hand, you know, it's all a wild card, isn't it? So the only thing that could have really been done was, you know, launching combat air patrols and also interceptions via ground-based air defense to prevent any further incursions and also to prevent incursions within the airspace.
Great. And Asim, what are your thoughts?
So I really want to compare this to the 2019 Balakot incident because it's important to contrast this episode with that. And I feel like the Indians were under the impression that this would play out like that episode, but slightly, you know, escalated. However, PAF did not, you know, react the way that the Indians were expecting. What I mean by that is the Indians stayed on their side of the border, right? Yes, they did escalate to striking not just Balakot, but, you know, as far down as, you know, South Punjab, right? But that was like the escalation on the Indians' part. But in that episode, you know, in 2019, Pakistan did not, you know, shoot down the Indian aircraft at that time. It waited and then responded. And in that episode, you know, in that conflict, Pakistan shot down the Indian aircraft. But this time around, the rules of engagement were different for PA, right? So as soon as they, you know, confirmed that the Indians were attacking, they were given the go-ahead to shoot down Indian aircraft inside Indian airspace. So maybe the reason this air-to-air flight was so lopsided was because the Indian Air Force was not expecting the PAF to react the way that they did. And that's sort of my impression.
So I do see the point where I think the PAF, at least on the opening night, definitely approached this as a lesson from 2019. So at that time, they did not respond in real time. There was a delayed counteroffensive that happened about, I think, up to 36 hours later. This time around, they wanted to ensure that whatever India was trying to do, it would get intercepted at some level. And I think that's where the acquisitions of both the J-10 and the HQ-9BE sort of factored in. So the HQ-9 did offer that territorial defense, quick reaction response layer. And then obviously the J-10s were able to basically, and the J-17 Block 3s were able to follow up with that, you know, cross-border air-to-air engagement. So definitely in line with how you observed the change of the rules of engagement. I think the PAF this time was potentially under the impression that, hey, if they can potentially intercept or interdict the Indian air operation right from the get-go, that could potentially help de-escalate, maybe discouraging them from following up with a bigger strike. And what are your thoughts on that? I'll start with you, Arslan.
Yeah, I agree, because we didn't see much Indian Air Force action further on during the conflict. We saw that the Indian Air Force kind of took a step back, and also the Army and potentially the Navy, I'm not too sure, but specifically the Army picked up a lot of the slack. And then we saw some limited strikes from the Air Force. I believe I saw an interception of a Rampage. And potentially we may have had some air-launched BrahMos, but I think it was a much more limited Air Force response and Air Force action than it would have been, than it was compared to the initial operation.
And this sort of points to, you know, the unpredictability of escalation, right? Because we're speculating that the PAF might have thought that this was a de-escalation like effect, right? To shoot down the aircraft right there and then would be de-escalatory. But evidently the Indians took that to mean something escalatory, right? So they escalated over the next few days. So this just goes to point out the dangers of, you know, war or escalation.
I agree. And I think when with the PAF, as they ostensibly, you know, apparently, again, these are claims and they're varying different layers of probability as to whether these claims are certain or like real or not. But if with the PAF claiming that it shot down Indian aircraft over Indian soil, although it seemed that, at least according to the way the PAF tried to presented was that they said, hey, most of these aircraft fell over disputed territory. So there was a measure, there's a bit of an attempt to say, like, hey, we're not trying to, you know, let's say we're not trying to like instigate or cause a reaction from within the Indian heartland. We're really trying to contain it within Kashmir. However, I think just the way the PF might have, rather the way the Indians maybe received the message was that this could, that the PF could have been preparing for a bigger operation, that they were like almost like, you know, by shooting down their Indian aircraft within Indian territory or trying to do so, there's that message that, hey, this might be the start of an, you know, an offensive counter air operation that's about to happen or something of that sort. Would that be like an invalid assessment, or maybe that was just like, you know, with India, maybe that's not how they perceived it per se, but rather that, I guess, that it was something that they just didn't want to accept either way. Like, hey, like if we were able to engage, if we wanted to do a standoff strike in your territory, then you cannot just go and intercept them unless we hit the border.
So I feel like, again, this is sort of, we're guessing these things, right? Because we're not in the planning rooms deciding these things. But if I had to guess, it's kind of like the Indians did not have an off-ramp after their jets were shot down. And so it's more that than, you know, them expecting some kind of bigger response. Because I don't believe that the Indians believe that, you know, Pakistan is capable of, you know, for example, knocking out the Indian Air Force or anything like that. So PAF is defensive in nature. So I don't think they expected, you know, the PAF to strike in some big way. I feel like it's just that it's kind of embarrassing to not have an off-ramp in that situation, right? Because you got a lot of jets shut down, there's videos everywhere, and, you know, somehow that needs to be managed.
So Arslan, I want to now step into day two, May 8th. So the sense I got was that, you know, we got into an exchange of loitering munitions from both sides. And then Pakistan sort of strategically fell into this weird, you know, this weird threat. Like, it's basically the Pakistani policymakers started issuing the threat that they would respond at their time and place of their choosing. But it seemed like on the ground that India really began to start pressing and regrouping really effectively from May 8th. What are your impressions of that?
Yeah, I agree. We can see that, and we can also see the impact, the psychological impact also of the initial confrontation between the Pakistan Air Force and the Indian Air Force here in action when they start to clear up, you know, air defenses, or they attempt to clear up air defenses as well. Both Army and Air Force air defenses start to sort of sweep them up to clear that sort of airspace for themselves, potentially to set up for another strike, particularly because we know later down the line as well that they conducted another strike and then also further attacked Pakistan Air Force bases. So I do think that first opening day had a significant impact on the psychology of the Indian Air Force and the entire situation.
And Asim, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I certainly believe that, you know, the use of loitering munitions over, you know, populated areas like Lahore and all that had a big psychological, you know, impact on the Pakistani public. And that was sort of something that was missing in Pakistan's response. And I feel like that is something that, you know, went unaccounted for, you know, kind of like the loitering munitions were kind of like terror weapons. Like, they obviously didn't do much damage, like on the first couple of days, but they were more being used as a psychological weapon. So I think that's something that, you know, is like a new thing that needs to be analyzed in terms of the Indo-Pak scenario.
Also, just one thing to add, it also showed that everything is within reach, right? Because we had, you know, loitering munitions intercepted and also successfully hit very, very close to GHQ as well. So it shows on the Indian side and also on the Pakistani side that nothing is safe. And that's also something that the Indians further reinforced down the line in consequent strikes as well.
So speaking of, so now we hit into May 9th, and now I think from the way things were playing out on the ground, by May 9th, it seemed that India was upping the momentum and pressing. And Pakistan, remarkably, went on public and basically said to the news media and international actors, basically, that, hey, we're looking to de-escalate and we want diplomacy to find a way. So at this moment, it seemed that by May 9th, the momentum had pretty much shifted to India, and that whatever potential tactical gains the PAF might have generated on May 7th seemed to have sort of been, I would say, let's say, withered out or fizzled out as a result of just this strange delay on the Pakistani side in actually doing a counteroffensive, and then also just the way the psychological effects were unfolding. Now, I think the question is, you know, we cannot go into the minds of Pakistan's, you know, top decision makers as to why they made certain decisions, but I think it would be interesting to know how much of what they didn't do was a result of constraint rather than restraint, which is put another way. Was it that it just could not muster that capability that quickly the way India did? Like, did India come into this more prepared with a secondary response, tertiary response? You know, did India game plan better, would you say? I'll start with Asim.
So I sort of feel like, yeah, so I agree with that. So that India certainly came in better prepared for this. And we also have to keep in mind that, you know, Pakistan is a much smaller country. It has a much smaller military and it has a much smaller defense, right? So to expect, you know, Pakistan to, you know, match Indian actions tit for tat is difficult. And again, even diplomatically, Pakistan is in a very weak position compared to India. So I can sort of, you know, imagine why Pakistani planners would be trying to de-escalate, trying to compromise, because on one hand, they do have a lot of weaknesses, right? And on the other hand, they have this, you know, giant adversary that they cannot hope to match. So I kind of feel like up until May 9th, Pakistan was just trying their best to end this, you know, conflict with that score, whatever that was. I don't believe on May 9th that Pakistan would have liked to respond, because frankly, Pakistan cannot, you know, sustain a large campaign of, you know, loitering munitions at this point, according to, you know, my opinion, I guess. Because I don't believe, you know, I guess we're going to talk about this more later, but in terms of loitering munitions, I don't think we've built up enough of like a stockpile of those guys to be able to match India's response at this point in time.
And then bleeding into the final day, now I'll talk to you. I'm going to ask you this, Arslan. So Pakistan on May 10th did initiate its counteroffensive op, Operation Punyanul Marsus, and it claimed it struck a wide range of Indian military facilities, with specific claims about neutralizing an S-400 using a pair of CM-400 AKGs launched from a JS-17 and destroying two BrahMos sites. So what are your observations on this operation? And do you think that it ultimately was something that, let's say, just literally scratched India, but did not really amount to much? And, you know, was, yeah, like, let's start there, because we have a post-mortem after that, basically.
Yeah, so I agree. Again, from day one, as Asim said as well, the atmosphere in Pakistan wasn't necessarily escalatory of nature, right? It was sort of, we need to respond. And within, particularly within the decision makers as well, it seemed more like a situation of, we need to respond in a level-headed manner. And from day one, I had been saying, I believe the kind of retaliation we're going to see is going to be similar to what we saw against Iran, where we'll see some limited rocket artillery strikes alongside a couple of, you know, maybe a couple of drones and whatnot. And at that point, they'll call it level. And that's exactly what happened here. And I truly believe that if on the initial strike by India, civilians weren't killed, the government would have called it level there once they had intercepted some Indian aircraft. But in terms of the further strikes, you know, against S-400s and whatnot, on the claims of those, I believe at this point there was quite the appetite for retaliation, and also a level but sort of slightly escalatory retaliation, in the sense where they don't want to just hit back at the same level where we got hit. They want to hit above that. So that's, I believe, that's sort of where the S-400 and the BrahMos sites comes into the play as well, is because in the same way the initial action by the Pakistan Air Force was a hit to the Indian Air Force and changed the kind of psychology of the whole conflict, in the same way, the S-400 and the BrahMos, particularly the BrahMos, seem to be a real thorn in the side of the forces, right? Effectively, you know, they effectively carried out whatever they needed to with impunity. You know, there were some BrahMos interceptions that we can reasonably confirm with, you know, images and pictures and whatnot. But for the most part, they got through, they did what they needed to. So in that sense as well, I believe that the strikes against BrahMos and S-400s were sort of that tit for tat, we need to hit you where it hurts kind of thing. But other than that, it also just seemed like a very level-headed, very limited response that literally, as you said, scratches the surface. But it seemed more geared towards domestic consumption than actually sort of any amount to anything, any damage on the Indian side.
I agree. You know, one of the things I observed as well, I mean, especially through May 9th and leading into May 10th, was that public opinion within Pakistan, it was starting to mount quite a bit of pressure on the establishment for a response. And I think with the way the PAF, or rather, let's say the way the joint operation response actually happened, when we go into the post-mortem, maybe not in this episode, maybe later on, we'll find that it wasn't even as cohesive and tightly deployed and planned as the way the Indians seem to have approached it. Like with the Indians, they seem to have like a backup plan. Like, hey, like if our air engagement thing, for whatever reason, does not drive home that sense that we can impose our interests on Pakistan, then we are going to regroup and then commence to stage two. And with stage two, they'd use loitering missions. And if that didn't really push the needle, then they commenced to stage three, which was the Bravo strike. So, and then who knows what stage four and five would have been, but I imagine it would have just been deeper and deeper within India's conventional arsenal, basically. But with Pakistan, the response was more like, okay, let's, in isolation, this force needs to do this thing, and this other force on the ground needs to fire that thing. On the opening salvo, a lot of claims were made very quickly. Like, I noticed that with the PTV broadcast, it was like, the operation, the counter operation is now going ahead, right? This is why it's so important and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly it's like, we destroyed an S-400. Then we destroyed a Brahmo site. And we destroyed this, we destroyed that. It's like, huh? That's like, how were you even able to verify that quickly at night, right?
Yeah.
And it didn't really even, and once we go into the post-mortem, we're going to probably see that not a lot of assets were even used for whatever reason, it seemed. So it seemed that the Pakistan, yeah, as I agree with you, Arslan, I think the Pakistan counter operation was basically for public consumption. And it was no surprise that, you know, they had potentially, maybe Pakistan had to get this like hit into the picture, like they had to get that punch in before the US can come in and really like settle the issue, because I think public opinion was just boiling over at that point.
This was
a credibility issue.
Yeah. And also, you saw after the strikes, what the atmosphere, you sort of, there were two camps, right? After the Pakistan Air Force hits on the Indians, and there were two camps. There was either we need to retaliate, or we've kind of done enough now, you know, we're happy with what we've done. Let's just call it level here. But as soon as the Indians carried on striking, the next day we had the Brahmos hits on the air bases, and also some drones, I believe two, three drones hit Lahore or whatever. At that point, there was no two camps. It was one camp. It was, we need to hit hard. But then, again, as I said, in terms of public consumption, right, you know, you had such heavily publicized strikes. You know, you had rocket launchers, Fatah launchers, and you had a camera crew there with banners taped to the side of the launchers, giving a speech and everything. This was clearly a public consumption thing and nothing more. And I also think that Indian strikes gave them an off-ramp, right? You know, Indian loitering munition strikes and Brahmos strikes and whatnot, they had to retaliate there and then. And they knew that if we retaliate now, we can kind of just, you know, call it quits here. Whereas I genuinely believe if we hadn't seen those counter-strikes by the Indians in the morning against the air bases and against the civilian populations and whatnot, the escalation probably would have been a little bit greater as well. You know, they would have had a little bit more time to plan, regroup, rethink, and also then retaliate and attack. Whereas this time, they had to act on a dime and whatever there is. You know, it seemed like they had to act on a dime. You know, the missiles came in the morning and by the evening, they had to respond. So I genuinely think this is much more geared towards domestic consumption. And also, it was sort of, okay, we've got this opportunity to de-escalate things and call it level. Let's just take it now. Let's just call it quits here. We'll do some counter-strikes and retaliatory strikes and just call it quits there. You know, we'll say we killed a S-400 or this, that. We'll hit them where it hurts so that we feel good about it, and let's call it quits. Mm-hmm.
So in relation to quits, Asim, I think we should move into, and you can also give your thoughts on May 10th, but I think we should also move into post-mortem. So I think, Asim, we can all agree that, and it's going to be, we might be quite contrarian with Pakistani public opinion right now, or Pakistani analyst opinion, but India did, as the kids say, bring the receipts to show that it inflicted much more impactful strikes on the PAF's facilities, including aircraft hangars. And I think except for the May 7th assessment by the PAF DG public relations, and I'm just saying in relative terms, I'm not saying that even if that was, you know, acceptable, but let's say in comparison to that initial assessment, Pakistan's battle damage assessment after that just wasn't up to the point where it needed to be to demonstrate success from May 10th. Hence, a lot of the open question marks, which we're getting into today.
Just before we go into that, I just wanted to say, like, I'm thinking about the May 10th thing. So I believe the both sides do this, right? So they all have these tiny plans about doing something, right? So, for example, there's probably a plan in AHQ that says, you know, mission destroy S-400 at Ulanpur or whatever. Right. And there's another plan, launch, you know, this strike, Fatah 1 strike on these 10 targets or something. And there's like a library and family of these plans that are probably presented to some person who's deciding what a response needs to be. And when the Indians struck at night with that escalated reaction, I think there was very little time to react. Whoever that person was making that decision had to, you know, pick one or two of those plans and just put them into action immediately. And I believe that's why, you know, we saw that everything, A, was very hardly choreographed. Like, for example, we saw videos and pictures and all that stuff. And also why PTV immediately knew that, you know, S-400 had been destroyed and stuff like that. So I think these were like pre-made plans that were not fit for what they were meant to do on May 10th, but they were the best things that they had. Of course, if we were going into like a protected war, all these plans would go away. But in this, you know, low-level pre-war skirmish stuff, all of these plans are being, you know, implemented on both sides. So, you know, that's something I noticed about May 10th.
And then in terms of the battle damage assessment, so now we're like going past the conflict a bit and looking at the post-mortem observations. And I mean, I think a cursory look at Twitter, if you really, really look at it, you know, it seemed that at one level, okay, like there's reasonable probability that the PAF shot down a number of IAF aircraft, fair. But then there is near certain probability that that India was able to really strike at the heart of the PAF on the ground with the BrahMos. I mean, we saw like two hangars in two air bases, which were meant to be the interior air bases. So these were not meant to be like the forward operating front line. Like these were meant to be like main operating bases a bit further back from the border with hangars with holes in them, basically, right? BF Bolari and BF Shahbaz. So with that, and in India really showed its receipts, or rather the evidence to say that, hey, like their attacks were effective. So in relation to that, Aseem, like, what are your thoughts on like just the that aspect of the conflict?
Yeah. So one thing I just want to reiterate that Arsalan pointed out in the beginning was because Pakistan and India's unique nature and their close distance, it's really hard to defend against most of these things. So just as easily as the BrahMos could, you know, hit like an interior base in Pakistan, if it had some weapons of some sort, could also reply, and it would be very hard for the Indians to intercept that as well. So that is sort of the preface to this sort of thing. So it's really hard to defend when you're so close to each other. Regarding battle damage assessment, so this goes beyond the scope of, you know, this conflict and the forces, but we know that the Indians have a very well-developed space program, right? And that's sort of showing at this point. Pakistan's space program, unfortunately, has suffered a lot, and we don't have the capability to, you know, monitor Indian, you know, locations relatively frequently, right? And whatever satellite information we get is probably from, you know, allies like China. So I think that sort of greatly hinders our ability to, you know, sell whatever attack we've done. So in this day and age, it's a lot about perceptions, right? So like, as you said, you need to have the receipts. So even if, you know, Pakistan destroyed all the targets that did, nobody in the world is going to believe that unless you put out images. And unfortunately, we couldn't do that, right? So, and that should be sort of a wake-up call to our military establishment that, you know, space is like an important thing to focus on. And we need, you know, a significant presence in space.
But, you know, it really contrasts, and it maybe even speaks to a little bit of a regression because, you know, back in 2019, the PAF's BDA over Swift for Tort was very tight. Like they had like really, really good footage from the H-4 standoff weapon, which they, you know, they basically built under license from South Africa, right? And I know it was a different approach because like this was like a data linked, you know, missile with their munition, which they had like electro optics, like a camera onto it. But the point being is that, you know, it's surprising that like that, even in lieu of a space program or a mature space program, that the thought was not put in that, hey, like this is a narrative driven cesspool here, South Asia. Like people run off what they hear based on third, fourth, fifth party information. There's unfortunately a very weak culture of genuine objective fact checking. And when, you know, especially when it contradicts the narrative, that you didn't have some sort of mechanism like a loitering munition or some other cruise missile or some drone to like try to observe what was going on. And before even making the claim, having that story set up.
Yeah. So again, I feel like that because of 2019, I do think that the Pakistani armed forces realized the importance of battle damage assessment. And that's why they did the video and the, press conference with all the video and stuff. But I feel like on May 10th, A, these strikes were rushed, right? So these were not options that were well thought out or, you know, these were like an immediate response of, they're escalating. We need to respond with something, right? So that's one aspect of it. And again, because there's so many targets that we're trying to hit, it sort of becomes very difficult to do battle damage assessment if you don't have satellites, like with the drones and stuff. That would have to be a very, very complicated, you know, an inter-services operation. Have been considered escalatory, right? Because if you have a large number of drones flying in the area, right, that Indians might have taken that to mean something else. So I do sort of understand that why we didn't have, you know, battle damage assessment, but, you know, it is a weakness that we have.
Aslan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so in terms of battle damage assessment, we're quite focused on the upper tier of it, right? The upper end of it, you know, satellites and drones and all this kind of fancy stuff. But there was a ton of open source stuff available, right? You know, even the strikes we had on the Pakistani side, before the Indians claimed them, we knew about them because everybody has their phones up. And in the same way, anything, if the forces wanted to confirm something, forget satellites, forget everything. There was a ton of open source information out there, you know, even in terms of aircraft interceptions. We saw Rafale pictures, we saw Mirages, Su-30s, MiG-29s, all of these things can be reasonably, of course, you can't confirm it 100%, but, you know, it adds more credibility to your claim. And in the same way, with these sort of strikes, you know, of course, they're claims, they're unverified claims, because we haven't seen that evidence. But let's say if the forces wanted to conduct some sort of really basic BDA to be able to present to the public, that stuff was widely available because everybody in the subcontinent has phones.
As a counterpoint to that, I would say, you know, there are some, you know, locations in the, you know, sphere that are available to people. But there, again, but then there are places like, you know, Jacobabad, which is one of the places that was hit in Pakistan. And that's essentially in the middle of nowhere, right? And there's not a lot of population around any of the that base. If India had not provided, you know, satellite images of that hangar with a hole, it would have been really difficult for them to, you know, prove that. And it would have been easy for Pakistan to deny that.
So I'm wondering, could one aspect, like, I mean, you know, we do want to preface that we're not going to just eat up what Pakistan gives us, you know, like on face value, we want to verify it. But could one of the weaknesses in Pakistan's abilities, you know, as you pointed out, Asim, have been the inability to secure that image intelligence in like real time or near real time as India did? Like, you know, I think we had people accusing the Indians of basically when they were showing their S-400, they basically, people were like trying to point out tire markings and stuff. Now, obviously that's, again, on their part might be cope, but at the same time, there is that valid assessment where like, if you had the right imaging intelligent tools, you could actually try to look into that and maybe potentially try to poke some holes into India's counterclaims, you know?
Yeah, so I certainly believe that Pakistan needs to think very carefully about whatever plans it has and incorporate BDA in all of them. So there can be no plans without BDA, because in the Indo-Pak scenario, they're kind of pointless. So yeah, I sort of agree with you on that. Right, so yeah. BDA is very important. It's as important as
you. And you know what? You brought up another thing based on that, because, you know, why are BDAs important? And I think we also kind of have to like set the context of the way the South Asian conflict environment sort of has become. Like after 71, idea that there would be territorial exchanges or territorial changes to prove that you actually won demonstrably kind of went out the window. Mm-hmm. There was a sense that because of the nuclear deterrent and other factors, not least also America's increased interest in South Asia, that the territories have to basically largely stay the same. So in the absence of literally capturing land, you can only use BDAs and assessments and narratives to kind of prove which side won.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's really where so that's really the reason why this sudden focus on BDA. Because I remember I think it was the Indian side, you know, they said that there'd be losses in conflict, but what matters is that we achieved our operational results and whatever it takes to achieve it. But the thing is that, okay, like, is this, has the conflict
scenario just devolved to where we're just counting, like, you know, what is the operational result? Like, just you hitting ABC site? That doesn't, like, people want more than that because, you know, it's like, okay, but if you're going to hit ABC sites, but you're still going to get hit by Pakistani military, then you're not really imposing your interests as you think you are. So that's where the BDA stuff is. Like, I think that's where India regrouped and came back and said, oh yeah, and we also poked holes into their hangars. That kind of set the tone against Pakistan a bit. Mm-hmm. So Arslan, I think this is we're going to go into the part where I think you've been really itching to get into. So, you know, like I think on May 7th, to Pakistan, it seemed like this was going to be like an extension of 2019. A lot of the same stuff. India was going to attempt this large-scale air operation. This time the PF will be there to stop it. May have been able to stop it to an extent. However, things just went off the rails, at least from Pakistan's perspective, a little bit after that. And that's where India, when it regrouped, it began to now really focus in and leverage its surface-to-surface missiles. And, you know, just as like a bit of a historical thing, I think this is really interesting to bring up, is that, you know, in 1971, India also introduced another technology into the South Asian environment, which was the subsonic anti-ship cruise missile. And that thing, like, I think it was a Strix, but that was used to such an effective level that it essentially not destroyed, but really damaged the Pakistan Navy, especially on the west side. Basically, you know, it was this introduction of a new weapon system. In the Western world didn't really have the means to stop it at the time. It took quite a few years before the necessary solutions emerged to stop that kind of weapon. It seems like we're back there again with the BrahMos, right, Arslan?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I keep saying this, but it seems like a sort of change in psychology, right? After 71 and after the Strix strikes on Karachi, the Navy has gone completely the other way, right? They've built up this really, really strong area denial sort of network, and they're also heavily investing in surface-to-air missiles, you know, land-based and on top of ships as well. So in the same way, I think we're going to really see this shift in mentality and shift in change. Potentially, if it's a short-sighted thing, you know, potentially we might see the forces further induct some sort of, you know, supersonic cruise missiles or whatever, and potentially there is an option already there, you know, with the PN operating CM302s. Potentially, you know, they could work out a solution where they go back to the OEM and design, you know, a warhead, you know, a bit more optimized to the anti-surface role or whatever, S-400s and whatnot. But I think we're going to see this shift now where the forces are going to look to inducting more advanced cruise missiles, particularly supersonic ones. But on the other hand, I really want to emphasize this, the Pakistan's response was very, very held back. You know, there wasn't a lot of the more advanced weapons, you know, that we've been seeing recently were not used. So whether this does definitively mean, okay, look, we need to go completely this other path about our procurements, is not seen, right? Because the forces kept their cards really close to their chest. They didn't use everything and also everything at their disposal. Whereas what we saw from the Indian side is they kind of used the upper tier of the top tier of their weapon systems. You had Scalps, Rampages, BrahMoses. Whereas on our side, you know, Fatahs and you know, Yihas and whatnot. Nothing particularly groundbreaking, particularly when you compare it to what else the force have in their inventory.
Mm-hmm. So it seemed like, I think one thing I want to get your thoughts on, like, could part of Pakistan's lack of response in real time have also been a result of just the way the armed forces are sort of organized? Like, they haven't really done a lot of stuff in the way of combined armed operations. Like, for example, that whole counteroffensive, it was under one name, but on the surface, it seemed like the PF and the army were both engaging. And it's interesting, they both had like literal ballistic missiles of different types. You know, at least on the PF, you had the CM-400 AKG and the army had the Fatah-1. So there's a sense that, okay, you have similar weapons, similar employment, but there was that lack of operational level cohesion on how to use it effectively. Like, for example, it's interesting that, you know, not normally, but let's say, like, you know, in a Ukraine-like situation, they might have employed that kind of air power and artillery power to say, you know what, we're going to target this air base. We're going to, like, destroy these assets specifically. As you said, we're going to have the BDA battle damage assessment stuff lined up. But however, we're going to do this in an integrated way, in a very focused way, to show that, hey, we can employ our resources in a really effective, focused approach. And don't you dare let us scale this up, because we can. That would have been the threat. Now, whether you could follow up, that's a different story, but you want to send that threat. Like, hey, we can scale this up. We're just going to give you a little taste of what we can do. But it seemed that it was just these like disparate strikes happened on Pakistan's mm-hmm. side, which didn't really tie in that cohesive story or anything.
Yeah. So again, I think this sort of goes back to the point I was talking about earlier, that these seemed like someone was given a family of options and they chose two options. One of them was for the one strikes done by the Pakistan Army, artillery forces. And then option two was an S-400 strike using JF-17s and CM-400 AKGs, right? So I don't necessarily think that the lack of, you know, inter-service coordination was like a deficiency. Maybe that was intentional because Pakistan did respond. Even when Pakistan responded, it was sort of very held back, right? It was just Fatah-1s and a couple of CM-400s, right? As Arslan just said, Pakistan could have used a lot more things, but it chose not to. So I sort of feel that it was still, you know, toned.
Interesting. So then going on to more of a sobering, even a more sobering assessment, then the sense that we got was that, okay, the BrahMos was a real problem. Yes, the PAF's long range, high altitude coverages, which is primarily the HQ-9BE, HQ-16FE, and then this really random edition FD-2000, which came out of nowhere. And it's like, I didn't know that this was a thing that was still on offer, but it showed up as well. It decided to come into the party, basically. And essentially, like, it provided some level of coverage, but, and yes, there was some, you know, we have with like good probability that some BrahMos missiles were intercepted. However, a bunch did reach their targets. And the concern here is not so much just the missile in of itself. It's what if India had used this at scale as a full escalatory measure? Would we have been equipped to stop it? So I think I would love to get your insights and kind of start us off. Like, what's your thought on that?
Well, we can see that the Pakistan Air Force is a really, really effective force once it gets in the air. But what we've seen is so far, the Indians kind of potentially maybe do have the ability to just prevent that from happening, right? If we saw massive, because the Indians have scaled up BrahMos production so much. And also what we saw, these were some of the oldest missiles that they had in their stocks. And we know this because these were the Russian Seeker variants. The Indians have been using their own domestic Seeker for a while now. These were the oldest of the old Russian Seekers. So they have a really decent inventory of BrahMoses. And if they wanted to overwhelm every single defensive system we have and rain fire down, forget the nuclear option, the BrahMos option is there. And that's an option that, you know, is quite possible. If this conflict was to break out into a bigger scale war, I genuinely believe that air bases would be created and jets would stay on the ground. They wouldn't be leaving the ground. They would be turned to dust, potentially. And this is the thing, right? You mentioned this induction of, you know, FD-2000, HQ-9BE, and HQ-16FE. But these are all towards the upper tier of defenses, right? And what we see is this massive lack of coverage beyond long-range air defense. And we also see this with the Russians before as well, where they had S-400s and whatnot, and all these sort of long-range air defense systems, but they had nothing to cover the rest of the tiers. I believe this was in Syria or something. I could be completely wrong here. But, you know, the reason why Pantsir was introduced was to protect those systems and also create a little bubble around them to intercept those harder to get targets like drones and UAVs and whatnot. And in the same way, we've got this massive issue now where we've got all these upper tier air defense systems, but we've got nothing else. The Air Force has HQ-9s, whatever, you know, up to 250 miles down to, you know, 120 with the FD-2000. But then on the other side, the other tier is just SEWAs, right? Because SPADA was relegated to SEWAs paired with Sky Guards. So there's that massive gap between like 10 to 120 kilometers. And that's the sort of gap that really would have carried the bulk of this interception work. And we saw this on the Indian side as well. Barrack-8s, Spiders, we saw a lot of Spider interceptions. We saw a lot of QRSAM and MRSAM. And also, this middle tier did a lot of the carrying work. You know, the S-400, even with that, we didn't see a lot of those long-range missile shots. We saw 9M96s, you know, 30, 20-kilometer shots, sort of, as opposed to these really long-range shots. And we don't necessarily have the ability to be able to take out these sort of fast, quick reaction systems, because the defenses we're using are really geared towards those longer range threats. One important thing to note is also the HQ-9 doesn't use a variety of missiles, right? There's one missile, that's it. It's the sort of not amazing at one thing, but decent at everything, right? As opposed to having something specialized like the S-400. So you've got 9M96s, 40N6Es and whatnot. So, you know, you've got the long-range missiles to take out, you know, supporting aircraft. And then you've got the shorter-range stuff to be able to take out threats like BrahMos and cruise missiles. We don't have this. So I really think that's one of the lacking areas. And also, in terms of SEWAs as well, potentially one of the bigger takeaways from this is we also need to bulk that up significantly. We had a lot of work being done by the Sky Guards. We saw them firing all day long, and it was really, really successful. I believe out of the 25, 26 drones sent in on the, was it the 9th or the 8th? We saw most of those intercepted. Yeah. I believe we only saw two hits on footage, and the rest of them, we either saw them downed non-kinetically, electronic warfare and whatnot, or we saw them ripped to shreds by Skyguard, and also, you know, HQ9s and HQ16s and whatnot. But what we're really lacking is this middle tier to be able to defend against the threats like Brahmos.
You know what? Like, it makes me wonder, because when this current Chief of Air Staff, when he, Air Chief Marshal Bobber, when he came in, it seemed that he basically directed the PAF to start building the integrated air defense layer. Right. I mean, prior to him, there was not a lot of attention given to long range or medium to long range SAMs. Like, really, the SAM system was primarily designed for point defense coverage of the air bases. Interestingly, or unfortunately, that did not work against the Brahmos either, because I guess those systems were a bit older. But it sounds like it's one of those bad luck scenarios as well, where air defense work was in its relative beginnings. Like, cause remember, India had a huge head start in really building that integrated air defense system. They've went through multiple maturation cycles. Like, the cycle they're at now, it's like they probably have one of the most sophisticated and capable air defense systems in the world at this moment in terms of density, advancement of missiles, diversity of missiles, and so on. Whereas the PAF was really at a, you know, if ACM Barber started the project in 2022, 2023, they only had 2 years, and whatever they had is what they had. So I think in this conflict, and plus, you know, who dealt with supersonic missiles at this scale before?
Like, yeah, exactly.
It's always been, like, I mean, especially with this limited strategic depth that Pakistan has, like, at least Ukraine had a bit of a buffer, but it's just so that it was like there's just a bunch of factors that just resulted in a bad luck situation.
And that's right? The thing, right? Yeah. Is from detection to interception, it's a matter of seconds, right? Something like a FD-2000, the claimed interception ranges on the data sheets and whatnot is about 6 to 20 kilometers or 6 to 25 kilometers and whatnot. So that doesn't give you a whole lot of time. And I'm willing to bet you it will be on the lower end of that scale. So you only have a matter of seconds to be able to actually carry out these interceptions and detections as well. And that's the other thing, right, is depending on where it's launched from, you've got hills and mountains of Kashmir down to potentially a little bit more breathing room down south. But you've got so many issues here, flight profiles, terrain, all these things, which create a detection problem. But then we also have the interception problem. And one of the key differences here between the Pakistan and the Indian Air Defense Network is the Indians seem to have bulked up their middle to lower tier significantly, whereas on our side, what we've done is bulked up that upper tier significantly and just done literally nothing for the middle tier. You know, on the Indian side, we saw work being carried out by Samars even, and those are R-73s launched from the ground, you know, Houthi style. And that's not something out of our technical abilities to be able to do, right? You know, we've got ample stocks of PL-5s and AIM-9s and whatnot to be able to convert into that. So this middle tier of air defense can be filled domestically, locally, and it's something that the Indians have done, right? QRSAM, MRSAM, Akash, literally everything under the sun, they've got such a dense network of medium-range air defense systems, whereas on our side, we've got literally nothing.
You know what, like, another interesting aspect here, and we're going to actually branch into a different topic, but I just want to, like, kind of conclude on this, because we'll be talking about the Brahmos threat and what Pakistan can do about it in our next episode, actually. And
yep.
Just so we're clear, both episodes will be published at the same time so that we're not going to leave you hanging for a week. But I think one of the interesting points is that we have to also account for Pakistan's unique geographical reality. Like, it lacks relative strategic depth compared to India. Its neighbor, its adversary is, like, right there, like, literally right there facing it. So even when you look at a solution like the HQ-9B, I think some people might, especially on the other side of the border, or maybe more broadly, say, okay, like, these SAM systems didn't do it. They couldn't stop the Brahmos. But they couldn't stop the Brahmos in the Indo-Pak theater. These systems were primarily fundamentally designed for the Chinese requirements. And China forgets strategic depth. Like, they have regional depth.
Yeah.
Like, they have layers and layers. Like, for them, the concern isn't even mainland China. It's like how the fight's going to go, how the fight's going to unfold in the South China Sea. So for them, it's a very different type of reality. So when they readapt a system for the PLA for export, the changes they're making, it's not designed for a different market, right? It's really designed for, like, okay, we just want to make sure it doesn't reflect exactly what the PLA has for security reasons. Yeah. Otherwise, it's really just that missile designed for that environment. So to be clear, you know, even if, you know, let's say Japan, South Korea buy a whole boatload of Brahmos missiles, it might not work in China as well as it did in Pakistan, simply because of Pakistan's unique environment, which necessitates solutions designed for your unique environment. Like, you have to sort of, like, walk back and, you know, it's interesting, like, that was the kind of the mindset that went into the JF-17, was that we need a fighter that's unique to our requirements.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening is that not a lot of countries had the same requirements, so not a lot of countries would end up, you know, resonating with the JF-17, right? It just didn't have all the things that you would have expected for other people to have, but it just ended up working out really well in Pakistan's environment. It's somewhat similar when you talk about SAMs and stuff, I think, where it's not just a question of like, we need to get that next long range SAM. Hey, let's go and talk to this guy about this country about this system. It's more like, what is a system that's going to work with the constraints and realities that we have to deal with? And that could potentially result in something original, so to speak. It just kind of reminds me of the way Israelis approached the Iron Dome project. It's just like, no one else had that. That entire program was a result of a very specific situation to them. And after some testing and work, it started to ostensibly work out for them. So I think it's like, that's the thing we have to sort of caution observers in that, hey, like, it's not an indictment of Chinese weapons and of themselves. It's that sometimes you cannot just take something that was designed for one environment and then superimpose it on another, especially when given just the intensity of the Indo-Pak theater. So Asim, yeah.
And that's also something I quickly wanted to touch on. It's also, let's be grounded in our expectations and let's be realistic with our expectations, right? Is this is a threat that is not one that is easy to intercept or easy to take care of. We've got Western navies, you know, just a few days ago, the Royal Navy carried out an interception of a supersonic target drone. And this was hailed as a great success and a key milestone and whatnot. If that tells you, what that tells you is, you know, we've got, you know, those guys are celebrating a target drone interception by Aster. Aster, the HQ-9 is an old system. There's no denying it, right? This is a nearly three decade old system. The HQ-9B is nearly over a decade old. Let's be realistic with our expectations, right? It was not a system designed from the ground up to go ahead and intercept these kind of threats necessarily. You know, that's not necessarily what it's targeted towards, right? And in fact, we know this because in the Pakistani Air Force, the HQ-9BE is more targeted towards TBM interceptions as well, right? The kind of the radars and all that stuff they're using are specifically designed for TBM interceptions. So having our realities and having our expectations also grounded probably helps the situation a little bit more as well, because these sort of failures don't necessarily mean it's a bad system, right? And we can see this because what the HQ-9 afforded us was a bubble that the Indian Air Force had to, it was another thorn in their side, right? If the Indians wanted to carry out strikes within our territory, that's another consideration they have to make. And that's also another significant threat, because we also heard about some potential interceptions of aircraft by HQ-9. We had a drone intercepted for sure, I believe. And then there was some dubious claims about a Su-30 or whatever. But what I'm trying to say is here, well, it may have not done what we expected it or wanted it to do against Brahmos. What it did do is create a buffer between the Indian Air Force and their ability to come within our territory, which relegated them into conducting standoff strikes.
It was an acquisition made in response to 2019.
Yeah, exactly.
It did its job in that context.
Precisely.
And now the PF has to think about 2025. So in relation to that, Asim, I'm going to ask you a very straight up question. Are Chinese weapons any good?
Yeah. So I think... even after all of the, you know, caveats that we've given, I certainly believe that everything that Pakistan put into use of Chinese origin in this conflict was of substantially good quality, right? Because if we recall 2019, we sort of got the sense that PF did not want to use SZ-10s and instead wanted to use AMRAAMs, right? American air-to-air missiles. But this time around, we saw that the PAF had confidence in using the Chinese air-to-air missiles exclusively. So I think that sort of reflects the PAF's confidence in, you know, Chinese systems as well.
I will have a podcast with an interesting guest down the line who's been following the Chinese stuff for a long time. It's not the guy who you think it is. It's another guy. But I'll get the other guy too. But I think one of the things we have to... I think the world was weirdly taken by surprise, but it shouldn't have been surprising, because all the ingredients were there for China to produce really good weapon systems. Like everything from a very, probably, you know, if we talk about Pakistan's threat environment, China has the worst threat environment. Like you have literally three, four major powers, one global superpower, three economic juggernauts, and like a bunch of pretty strong regional powers all kind of like positioned against you. and they're the world's leading industrial engine, number two R&D spender in real dollars. I mean, and then innovator in miniaturizing electronics, which I think in the context of the PL15 is very critical because this detail is being missed by analysts quite a bit. But like when you compare the development of the Meteor, for example, in Europe, like what was their threat environment? They were kind of envisioning, I think, like a post-Cold War world where you had a bunch of tin pot countries out there, like, you know, Iraq and whatnot, which maybe operated older generation aircraft. Maybe they would have that one-off squadron or two of Su-30s or whatever, which could be a threat. Like, let's say Algeria. Okay, they have a, on paper, a pretty good air force. They might have that super long-range Russian missile, but you could be confident that their electronic jamming is not up there. You could be confident that their sensor integration is not up there. You could be confident in so many assumptions. And then the way they designed the Meteor, it had great kinematics or it had great kinetic qualities by, you know, by virtue of the ramjet engine. It has a very good range, I mean, and a very good no escape range. But then the Seeker was mechanically steered. So like clearly it was designed for an enemy that was one or two generations behind you. Like mm-hmm. you were thinking, I'm going to knock out this big Russian plane. The Chinese came in with a PL-15 and gave it an active ESA Seeker, which is completely different. Like, you know, you're making a full generational leap in the Seeker. And it was designed specifically to deal with a dense electronic warfare environment. It was designed specifically to survive in that environment. Now, again, there are a lot of photos out there of missiles being, you know, of apparent shells just being on the ground. And with air-to-air missiles, including the AMRAAM and what have you, you're not going to have like 100% hit rate. These are meant to be disposable. These are not meant to be like they're not meant to be like the crown jewels of anyone's. These are fundamentally disposable systems. They're meant to get destroyed. Right. So this is going to happen. Like you're going to see missiles that are not that might not have hit their targets or might not have exploded in proximity or whatever. That happens. But the thing is with the Chinese is that they're going to take this data. It's going to go back into their feedback loop and it's going to come back with an improved batch. But the point being is that their threat environment and their industrial engine, the combination allows them to produce advanced weapon systems. Like the main refrain or the main problem you could have thrown at them was that you don't have real world data. This is all theoretical. And we would have discussions with Chinese, you know, analysts, and we say, like, your weapon systems are good on paper, but they're very built with a theoretical mindset. But now they're getting this real-world data. And now I think that next iteration is going to be interesting, at least from the air-to-air missile domain.
And I feel like the AESA radar on the PL-15 is, like, the biggest advantage that it has over almost all of the missiles that are in service anywhere in the world. So I think that's really a game changer, and as much as I hate the term, but eventually I think everyone is going to catch up, but let's hope we can catch up.
A quantum leap, as the PAF would put it.
Quantum leap, game changer, and there's another one to add.
No, I completely agree with that point. I think it's one of the biggest things that I've been saying is forget the range numbers, stop looking at ranges. The key differentiator here is going to be that low probability of intercept, really capable Seeker, because again, it's been designed with the US in mind, and they're really, really high-end jamming systems. And the Chinese expect that they're going to be facing a ton of, you know, opposition from really advanced jammers. You know, the US is now deploying gallium nitride jammers even. So they know that they're going to be facing this really, really dense electronic warfare environment and whatnot. So they've designed their stuff with this in mind. We don't necessarily have this threat. We don't necessarily need this sort of really fancy advanced electronics and whatnot for our adversary, but it works out in our favor, right? You know, against systems like the Rafale, where the range wasn't the biggest benefit here. The biggest benefit here was denying the adversary of their situational awareness, which is a sort of benefit that comes with these low probability of intercept Seekers.
I think one aspect also never to discount on the Chinese is to understand their ability to scale up production. You know, if you had 100 PL-15s and 100 Meteors in a war, as those get depleted, you can be assured that the next batch of PL-15s will have like 300 missiles there. Because it's just their ability to scale and ramp up production. It's just like, that's the reason why everyone outsources to them, even now, right? You know, you look at the green energy world, right? Like, there's no contest, right? It's like anyone who wants to develop a product in the world, like 90% of products out there, you're going to be involving the Chinese supply chain in some level. So when you look at these electronics or these, you know, integrated systems, this is their bread and butter now. I mean, they know how to ramp up production. So at least in one thing I found was like as an interesting aspect for the PAF in particular, like back in 71, one of the things that was like a thorn in their side was how the Soviets could supply the Indians really quickly. Like as tensions would ratchet up or as the situation would seem dire, the Soviets would be there and the Indians would just get like incredible numbers of Russian planes, like MiG-21s by the hundreds, Su-7s by the dozens, whatever. And the thing is that the PAF, you know, at best it could get like a few dozen F-6s from China. It had a big Mirage 3 order, which was only one third of which was completed by 71, which tells you like the French could not like ramp up for that. You know, they cannot ramp up production to even meet those needs at that time. So what about now? It's like even bigger question mark. Whereas now you have China, which is that industrial engine, where you finally have that big supplier. Like I think like in the post-2025 scenario, if the PAF wanted to pivot and acquire, let's say, more J-10s quickly, because it like, you know, I would be surprised if it didn't acquire J-10s, because it's really weird to say that the J-10 worked out for you and then not buy anymore, because especially when you have the infrastructure to operate it. But if that was the direction they took, they can get these aircraft in service pretty quickly, much quicker than India can get additional Rafales. I would say that the bigger threat for the PAF is not even the Rafale, it's what India will produce domestically, like the Tejas, and how they'll try to extend the Tejas' capabilities. And that's going to be, I think, in any post-2025 scenario, that'll be the next threat, actually, which, again, in Pakistan, your people will scoff at you, unfortunately. But the truth is the truth. When you look at that fighter, it's like, it's just a victim of project management and supply chain issues and weird stuff like that. It's not a victim of its own technological merit.
No, absolutely. And one other thing we saw was, we saw a real life example of this speedy deliveries to the Pakistan Air Force through the PL-15s. And the other thing we saw is in some of the missile wrecks, the seekers on the missiles had production dates in 2015. So either they're older. So either the Chinese have been able to really, you know, have stockpiles and stockpiles of PL-15 components, or they were able to send us some through their own inventory to be able to boost our numbers, which is, again, what you just mentioned.
Yep. So Asim, I see you added this into the list, loitering munitions. It was you, right?
Yeah.
So I'd love to get your thoughts on this.
Yeah. So as we discussed this in the beginning of the podcast, May 9th, May 8th, yes, we had a lot of promises and all that stuff, but primarily what we were facing was a sea of loitering munitions by India. They were basically throwing everything at us, including kitchen sink, right? All kinds of LMs. We saw, like, I can't even start to classify the amounts of loitering munitions we got. We got, you know, the Polish something, Warmate or something.
Yeah, Warmates. Yeah. Even target drones.
Yeah.
Even target drones.
The headliner was a Harop and the Harpy, but those were just like the cutting edge ones, right?
Yeah. So,
but also,
Sorry, yeah. So I think the Indians had like, so I keep talking about these plans, right? So the Indians definitely had a plan to, you know, send out all these loitering munitions at us. And so based on what I saw, either we don't have that capacity, right? So we don't have enough loitering munitions. We don't have either, or we don't have the plan to develop those in that amount of numbers, or we didn't want to deploy them. So these are all possibilities. But I'm leaning towards the option that because Pakistan only started doing loitering munitions, you know, a couple of years ago, or maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I don't think we have enough of a stockpile to have responded to India on those nights.
Yeah, it was a relatively recent addition. But one problem I saw on the Pakistan side in terms of loitering munitions from an industry perspective is that there were more designs than it seemed that they had actual inventory. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of designs that came out, both from the public sector and private sector, like at least 20 designs, maybe. And the problem, the red flag is when you're a design top, basically when you're design heavy, you're top heavy, meaning that you can do the R&D reasonably well. You can do the integration work reasonably well. You can produce prototypes and, you know, I guess proof of concepts and what have you. But when it comes to production scale, the problem is we've never, at least, I don't want to say never, but in the short term, it's not a factor because we're not an industrialized country. I think the problem in the discussion in Pakistan is that it's completely isolated and abstracted away from economy. And this is where industrialization, which over many years, Asim, you and I have been kind of, at least for maybe 7 years, we've been kind of like pushing for through Kuwa, is that if you don't industrialize, then you will never have the ability to scale up and ramp up production of your designs. Like South Africa is a really good example. Like Pakistan today, South Africa, you know, Denel and what have you, had designs. They had the A darter, right? They had even the H2, H4, the Raptor 1, Raptor 2. They had many designs. So it was never a question of producing the product. It was like, can you get this product into production so that we can induct it? And I remember actually one guy, he was telling me that when he spoke to the PAF about the A-Darter, so the PAF was actively considering the A-Darter, which is like the fifth generation air-to-air missile for the JF-17 Block 3. The issue was that when the PAF saw the A-Darter, it was like, great missile, looks cool, great promise on paper, but can we buy it? Like, can we get 100 of these by X timeline? And unfortunately, it wasn't still in development and it wasn't even in production. And it took Brazil, an industrial country, to come in and take it over the line after quite a bit of difficulty. And I think the South African industry couldn't recover after that. Once the state funding started drying up, ArmsCore, Denel, you can see what's happened to them. And I think, unfortunately, with Pakistan, that is the risk factor. Like, you have all these great, like, some of them are really good loitering munition designs. Like, some of them are really good designs. Like, some of them look like really promising products.
So to add to your point, we've seen in all these trade shows that Pakistan presents these very, very fancy looking loitering munition designs. And I sort of feel like they're trying to, you know,
attract,
present designs that, you know, look impressive and compared to Western designs. So there's like a small diamond or bomb copy or something like that. And yep, that might be great for, you know, someone who has a lot of money, but those things are not suitable for the Pakistani environment, which might actually benefit from something like what the Iranians have done with the Shahid drone, right? So take like a motorcycle engine, stick wings onto it, and that's your loitering munition. That's probably the loitering munition that Pakistan needs, right?
Or you go even more basic, like simple consumer grade electrical motors with fans, really super lightweight, very consumer grade carbon fiber. And the thing is, like, this is what happens when your defense planning doesn't tightly integrate with industry and the private sector, mm-hmm. is where if you came in after 2025, let's say like next week in June, and you said, hey, we need 100,000 loitering munitions. How do we get there? Or I need 1 million loitering munitions. How do I get there? Then there's a whole process of like, what kind of design can we build? How can we make it affordable? What can we produce locally? How can we ramp up production as quickly as possible? And when you get to that question, how can we ramp up production as quickly as possible? That's when you bring in the private sector. You tell them, look, our state-owned industry can only produce like 50,000 loitering munitions in 2 years. We need 950,000 more. And that's when you get that much desired investment. And the problem is when you don't have the economic literacy, I'm being very like obtuse about it, but we don't have economic literacy at the highest levels necessary. This is what ends up happening, is where you're kind of left scratching your head. And then ultimately you end up making the most, let's say like the most obvious decision in that environment, which is to go to China. And I think you wrote in here, will China step in or rip Pakistan off?
Yeah. So that is the big question, right? I mean, obviously China is selling something to us. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. So if you want to, you know, wanted to buy 1 million loitering munitions, I mean, you're obviously going to be paying a markup on that. So ideally speaking, like, Pakistan is not a rich country. Like, so you don't want to be in a position to be paying that markup. But, you know, at this point, we're just, you know, buying everything from China. And that sort of puts them, you know, as the sole supplier. And that's a recipe for getting exploited, right? They can charge anything they want. And, you know, they're a business and they're well in their, you know, rights to do that. And we need to, you know, either diversify our sources or get a local production line for these loitering munitions going, right? So, unfortunately, we do corner ourselves into these situations that are not great.
So one thing I think Pakistan could do, and it's a bit of out-of-the-box thinking that requires a little bit of vision in a sense, because you're going to have to take a short-term hit, but you can end up coming out of this with long-term gain. But let's say you're GIDS, or let's say you're NESCOM, really, because they're the ones who designed the thing. Like, you have a few loitering munitions, or any munition, to be honest. But you have, let's say, a loitering munition design. You've done the product development work. You've done the feasibility testing. You've built the prototype. You know how to get it into production, at least in the theoretical sense. But you don't have the industrial base in Pakistan to do it. What you can do is you can go to a Brazil, a Poland, I think those are the two big ones I can think of. A Czech Republic, a Czechia, I think it's the other one. Hungary. You can go to these countries that have the industrial base. And if they're interested in taking on a munition product, you basically say, okay, look, we're willing to license this design to you. but you need to give us X thousands of units at this price by this timeline. And then after that, we'll be cut free. Like, you can do whatever you want. You can take the design, you can appropriate it, you can make it your own. But we just need that. Like, this is a bit of a wartime kind of consideration. I think, I don't know, I believe the UK did this to some degree with America during World War II. And it didn't really, you know, obviously the UK might be like kind of, you know, slapping itself in the face a bit about it, but like it was a necessity. They had some engine technology, they had some R&D capability, they had some actual design work. They went to America, told American companies, hey, like, if you can get this to us in time at this point, then it's all yours. And it's sort of the thing you have to eat because you didn't do the work beforehand to scale up and build the industrial base. But then you can also tie in a secondary requirement where, not a requirement, but you can sort of say like, hey, like, if we can give you this design, can you help us build some of this production capacity in Pakistan? Like, can you transfer the manufacturing sites and what have you? Can you invest in this Pakistani company and do it? Again, see, this is like, you know, I think a lot of people make fun of India for their protracted defense negotiations, but there's a reason why they get protracted. It's not because of incompetence. A lot of the time, it's because they want to negotiate these details out and get those outcomes. That's why it took them so long to get to the Rafale deal, right? That's why it's going to take them a while to get to their next fighter deal, because they're not thinking 3 to 5 years, they're thinking 30 to 50 years. So for them, a contract period of 5 to 10 years is nothing. And I think that's the approach where Pakistan has to kind of take, is that, look, let's negotiate these details out. Let's offload some things. Let's give away quite a bit of stuff, but we'll get back that immediate thing. And then we can also start actually building our economy properly.
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to just add in this, actually two things. So one thing on the top point you've just made, I think the best bet is genuinely just going to be offloading whatever we can outside of country, and then having some sort of agreement where, you know, out of your 1,000 per week production run, you give us, you know, 100 or whatever in exchange for that. Because, you know, as we said, we lack the strategic depth, right? Whatever loitering munition or whatever munition factories we have churning out munitions during a conflict, they will be the first thing on the Indian forces' minds to take out. And we see this in Ukraine, right? Every single day, they're trying to take out whatever Russian weapons factories they can. You know, they took out a fiber optic site recently or whatever. The other thing I'd like to just touch on really quickly is, I still, while I agree with you guys in terms of building up production capacity and whatnot, I do think that there is a substantial inventory and stocks of loitering munitions within the Pakistan forces. But this limited response wasn't a sign of weakness, rather it was restraint, right? And I say this just because, look, we haven't seen the more advanced systems being used here. You know, there were just two. So the Pakistan Air Force had procured at least three different types of munitions from China recently, right? You had the Dark Angel, very cringe, whatever, but you had the Dark Angel, and then you had a larger version of it. And then you also had a Shahid type drone as well that would be launched from like a truck, you know, 5-6 cell launcher. So again, there was the capability, and also there was the stockpiles. And on the other hand, we know India ordered about 100 warmates, but you saw them using them very freely, right? So I think the stocks were there. I genuinely believe it just boils back down to that sort of restraint and that level of restraint being shown.
But you know, there is an advantage. Even if you have the stocks right now, there is an advantage to offloading the production in exchange for the design, that you build those track two partnerships that will potentially pay off in the long run.
Absolutely.
Like, you want to have those links in Poland, in Ukraine after the war, in Czechia, Slovakia, and whatnot, because you want to create an environment where these other players know that, hey, Pakistan means we'll do business with you. They'll come into the table with a fair mind, reasonable trade-off. Now, obviously, our reputation in that regard might not be the best up to this point, but I think now is the time you have to really build that up. And there are countries that, you know, they have the industrial base, but they just never did the defense R&D work. Right, you have the Polands, you have the the Czechs, you have the Hungarians, you have the Brazilians. They can absorb your designs and they can produce them at scale. They just, absolutely, you know, they're willing to do it. Like, and that's the thing. And I believe GIDS, the CEO of GIDS, you know, they went to Latin America, and it seemed like that was pretty much the proposition play.
And it's probably the best bet as well, right? Because it's the only way we can guarantee a sort of assured supply line during conflict, because we can't guarantee that when it's at home, right? We know, yeah, these are going to be prime targets. Whereas if we build up a small, you know, network of, you know, really reliable and trusted partners, you know, for example, Ukraine, right? Ukraine will need support. Ukraine does need support. Ukraine does need equipment. If we were to, you know, license them some of these products and whatnot and set up production there, you know, it's kind of a case of we scratched your back, now you scratch ours when it comes to wartime. And that's where it is, right? Is we really need to build up these partnerships abroad, far abroad, where India, where, you know, out of the reach of India, to be able to guarantee us those supplies and equipment during conflict.
Yep.
Just to play the devil's advocate, how are you planning to get these supplies from, let's say, Brazil or something into Pakistan during war? Because Ukraine has land borders with a lot of its allies, right? We are bordering Iran and Afghanistan, right?
With our quantum merchant navy, of course.
Well, that and also, but other than that, you know, I believe during wartime, you know, we'd in the previous conflicts, we'd move some assets over to Iran, and we'd also run, you know, commercial flights. They would ferry equipment between Iran and Pakistan and whatnot. So we could, again, this is what it comes down to, right? Is building up that network of really reliable sort of allies, you know, ports in Iran or ports, you know, wherever, you know, ports in Iran and airports and this and that, to be able to guarantee a safe-ish supply route, you know, through land borders in Iran or whatever.
I would take the more aggressive assumption and say once the wartime hits, there's no supply coming. Rather, you want to use every 2 years, three, let's say we have a, so between 2019 and now we had a 6-year period. Let's say India came out of this confident and slash ended 3 years. You want to use a 3-year period to stock up as rapidly as you can. So that's where you use the open commercial channels to get those munition stocks built up through Brazil, Poland, what have you, with the assumption that, yeah, it's going to probably close down in wartime. We can't really expect much after that, but we need to have the million loitering munitions, right? And I think that's the approach to take. The thing is, yeah. There's a better chance of us getting that many loitering munitions by offloading production and getting the Polish industry, the Hungarian industry, the Czech industry, the Brazilian industry, Malaysia, Indonesia, yeah. whoever. We get 10 countries to help us out. We give them the design. They can make it their own. Great. You know, good for them. We're the ones fighting a war.
Yeah. And also the other thing is, right, is Pakistan's strategy is never to have a drawn out, long sustained war, right? Yeah. It's always a high intensity, short term conflict until somebody steps in. So this fits in perfectly to be able to, you know, have this large stockpile we can deplete in, you know, a week, 10 days, 20 days, whatever. And at that point in time, somebody's probably going to step in and call it quits there anyway.
Sure. So I'm going to leave it there because I do want to get into that more in-depth BrahMos discussion for episode 2. So yep. I thank everyone for sticking with us and listening to the first episode. Obviously, you know, this is new territory for all of us. Primarily, you know, I've literally written Kuwa through print medium, so digital print no less, but you know, we are making that transition perhaps later than what many people have preferred, because we've had requests from people asking us to do a podcast for many, 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 many years. Kuwa's been around for 10 years, believe it or not. We're actually going to have a 10-year anniversary thing where we will show you some rebranding and some new product lines. We are going to be expanding the subscription tiers so that we can accommodate the Pakistani audience much better, or rather the South Asian, Middle Eastern audience much better. We'll be covering more areas and regions. That was always the intention. It's just that, you know, we've had to keep things tight for a few years in order to build up the capacity for it. But yet, once again, I thank everyone for listening, and we'll be refining, iterating on the podcast with every episode. So you will be seeing improvements in subsequent chapters, hopefully. Thank you. Take care and bye.